We are covering two books this morning, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. So if you want to turn over to 1st Chronicles, How many of you guys have read through 1st or 2nd Chronicles recently, like in the last couple of years? Okay. All right. Handful. Okay. Chronicles is some tough going. And I hope as a result of this, you get a better feel for what's going on. You need to know that in the Hebrew Bible, 1st and 2nd Samuel are one book, 1st and 2nd Kings are one book, 1st and 2nd Chronicles are one book. They present the whole of a historical narrative, and Chronicles is the same. If it's been a little while, I want to encourage you guys as part of your Bible reading, that you don't have to drill down on every single word and every single concept. The first 9 chapters of 1 Chronicles is genealogy. It's okay to read very quickly through some of that stuff. I want to tease out a couple of things from the genealogies, but I want you to be able to give yourself permission that it's okay to move through some sections of Scripture a little faster, maybe some sections of Scripture a little slower, because there is some good stuff in here. A couple of just interesting facts before we begin our deep dive. The original title in the Hebrew means the Annals of the Days. The Annals of the Days, and Chronicles is very similar to other ancient Near Eastern historical records of kings, where it would just be king date, king date, king date, king date, king date. In fact, I was trying to look it up. The Expedition Bible YouTube page, which you guys would all do well to check out. Such great stuff. Joel Kramer is the guy who runs that page. He lives in Jordan, Christian guy. We were watching something recently, and he was reading through something in the Old Testament, and it was just like this one-off, and I tried to find it just quickly this morning, where I think there was an eclipse just mentioned ever so briefly in the Old Testament, and there were annals written, I think, either in Babylon or Assyria, one or the other, and it also mentioned an eclipse there. And so what you could do is you could evaluate the two and get an exact date of what was going on and when. It was just this really neat thing. And as he showed the, I think it was a relief, which is like a piece of stone where they chisel out the information. I mean, it was just king date, king date, king date, king date, king date, and an eclipse. King date, king date, king date, king date. Like it was that fast. So it's kind of interesting. And some of this stuff, there are some pretty interesting nuggets of information. And I want to tease that out. So this is just the Annals of the Days. Many ancient Near Eastern kings did this. And we kind of wonder sometimes, why did they write it like this, very, very quick? You have to understand, like back in the day, to record things was very expensive. And it's not like people had computers or printer paper where it could just, you know, be cranked out easily. Everything was put together in abbreviated fashion. We don't know the author of 1st or 2nd Chronicles. Ezra the priest is often given as the probable author. If you read all the way through, you realize that whoever the chronicler was lived after the return of the exiles from Babylon. So he knew all of this information, and he compiled this information for us. The other thing that's interesting is that over 50% of 1st and 2nd Chronicles is unique material. A lot of times we think it's just a rehashing of 1st and 2nd Samuel or 1st and 2nd Kings, but actually what we find out is there's a lot of unique material in the book, and therefore, and let's be fair, a lot of that unique material are the genealogies, but it's helpful to know that there's a lot of stuff in here that is unique just to Chronicles. Some themes to keep in mind as you look through Chronicles. Number one, the theme of the total history of Israel starting at Adam all the way to the return of the exile. So the chronicler is very, very excited about, not excited about, but he views history as being very, very important. He sees there's this arc from creation to where he was in the return from Babylon, and so history is important. And just as a bigger picture point, history is important to Christians as well. We are not afraid of history. We're not afraid of what went on. In fact, historical corroboration of what has gone on in the Bible is one of our greatest assets. We love history. The Bible is a historical document. Everything that we believe happened in space-time history. It wasn't, you know, long, long time ago in Neverland or something like that. It was, and this happened on the 11th month and the 4th day of the month. We're very concerned about history and historical accuracy. And so this is what God has given us. A lot of people think, well, you know, we just believe everything by faith. Well, by faith, yes, we trust it to be true, but we can also go and historically verify a lot of it. And the more history is uncovered on the secular side of things, the more that the biblical history line is corroborated and found to be true. So you can trust the historical references in your Bible. The other thing is the importance of genealogies in the Bible. And I just want to take a little side note here. Why are genealogies important? Okay, it's where we come from, who came from where, okay? So historical record, just as a matter of historical record. What else?
It chronicles Jesus. Mm. It chronicles how that came about from the beginning of human time until today.
Right, yeah, it gives us that lineage all the way to Jesus. It's kind of interesting, there are almost 50 genealogies in the Old Testament. How many genealogies are there in the New Testament? It's not one. Two. Is there a third? No, there's just two. And they're both the genealogies of Jesus. So it's Matthew and it's Luke. Yeah, it gives us genealogies. And then we have all these admonitions to not get caught up in genealogies anymore. Like, all that's done away with. And so we know, Christianly speaking, that all of these genealogies are following the flow of history leading up to and proving that Christ or that Jesus is the Christ. So they do have purpose in them. And I just thought this was interesting. These are some statistics I pulled out years ago. So there are at least 50 genealogies in the Old Testament. There could be more depending upon how you count a genealogy, like even at the end of the book of Ruth, there's a quick so-and-so begot so-and-so, begot so-and-so, begot so-and-so. If you count that as a genealogy, that's one. And there just seems this constant drumbeat of importance of genealogy. Over 900 verses in the Old Testament are dedicated to genealogies. So that's longer than the book of Romans and the book of 1 Corinthians and Galatians combined are genealogies. So God saw the importance of genealogies. Yeah, so I give four reasons for genealogies. There's others. Number one, like Nick said, give an account of history. Number two, to show rightful inheritance. And we see that a lot around the kings. And then ultimately through Jesus, how is it that he is the Messiah? He's the rightful heir of the throne of David. It shows how prophecy is fulfilled. So-and-so begets so-and-so. Also, it sometimes shows how family lines are cut off. And sometimes that fulfills a prophecy as well. So pretty interesting. And I think it also shows God's grace, because if you look at who's in these genealogies, you realize how are they part of the messianic line? Like, how did they slip in there? Well, it's the same reason we slipped in there. It's God's grace towards us. So there's the importance of genealogies, big emphasis in 1 and 2 Chronicles on the life of David and then the life of Solomon. We've already seen that in 1 Samuel and Kings, but it's repeated again in the Chronicles. They have an outsized amount of space dedicated to their reigns. And interestingly, Chronicles, as opposed to Samuel and Kings, is usually considered more optimistic, way more optimistic than Samuel or Kings. Chronicles ends that the exiles have returned into the land. It's like this bright hope. to bring faithfulness back to the land. If you read through Chronicles, in contrast to Kings especially, you'll notice that a lot of the wickedness of the kings is really downplayed. And what they did right is really upheld. That doesn't mean that they never talk about the wickedness, but it's often downplayed. And then the other thing about Chronicles is it really just tracks the kings of Judah. It doesn't really mention, I mean, it mentions the kings of Israel, but almost only in relation to how they're engaging with the kings of Judah. Chronicles is really focused on the line of Judah, which makes sense because if it's written by Ezra as they're coming back from the exile, all they care about are the people that are left there and how do we get here, which is the history of Judah. Okay, that's a little crash course. Questions about 1 Chronicles before we get going? Anything you want me to answer this morning about 1 Chronicles? No? Okay. If you think of any, let me know. It's divided up into four. We're going to take the books together, and most people do. It's divided up in four sections. You see this here. The first section is the first nine chapters of the book, which is given over to genealogies. We'll read that here in a minute. The second is the United Kingdom, which is sort of the end of 1 Chronicles, or actually early on in 1 Chronicles, all the way to the beginning of 2 Chronicles. So we have the reign of Saul, which is a chapter or two, the reign of David, and the reign of Solomon. So that's the United Kingdom. Third is the Divided Kingdom. But again, it's an emphasis really only on the country of Judah in the south. And it was Judah in the south that went to Babylon. They were exiled there for 70-ish years and came back. So this little timeline that's up here, and I'm sorry it's hard to read, but this little timeline that's up here, the whole book of Chronicles covers all of that. Like the whole thing. So, well, except the last 2 inches or whatever. So it really does cover a lot. And then the last little bit is just three verses, and it's or two verses. It's the return of the exiles, which again is this little glimmer of hope. Let me just read some of the first chapter. So 1 Chronicles chapter 1, just to get a flow for how this works, it's really no nonsense. So 1 Chronicles 1:1, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So that's the first, 10, 12 chapters of Genesis in four verses. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Verse 7, the sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, Rodanim, the sons of Ham, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan, the sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabtika, the sons of Rama, Sheba, and Dedan. Verse 10, Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on the earth to be a mighty man. 11, Egypt fathered Ludum, Anemim, Lehabim, Nephatuhim, Parthusim, Kalshuhim, from whom the Philistines came, and Kafortim. Just real quick, what do you notice so far about the genealogy in these names?
Very little other words.
Very little other words, yep, just focusing on the names. Good. What's that? Yeah, they became nations. Yeah, this is where we get Egypt. Egypt was a guy, actually. And this guy had children and expanded. Yeah, so this is where we get the nations that we currently know. Yeah, verse 13. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. So Sidon is a city. It was a city-state along the coastline. And the Jebusites, they were the ones who dwelled in Jerusalem, remember, before David took them. Verse 14, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, and the Girgashites, and the Hivites, and the Arkites, and the Sinites, the Arvadites, and the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Verse 17, the sons of Shem, Elam, Ashur, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Meshech. 18, Arpachshad fathered Shelah. Shelah fathered Eber. And to Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. Hey, guys, please be quiet. And his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan fathered Almadad, Shelepeth, Hazarmaveth, Jera, Hadaram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba, Ophar, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were sons of Joktan. Shem, Arpachshad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, Abram, that is Abraham. So again, in 27 really short verses, the first third or so of Genesis is completely summarized. So this is very similar, again, to what you would read in an ancient Near East, Annals of the Kings, Annals of what was going on. It would just assume that you know. It wouldn't even need to say so-and-so begot so-and-so. It would just assume you knew, like, that the guy after was the son of the guy before. Like, and it would just run the list and go down. Okay, let's look at a couple other things. So within all of this are some interesting gems. And I know when we first started the Old Testament survey, some of you guys mentioned, you know, how do we connect the dots? How do we put storylines together? And sometimes you got to mine them out a little bit, and you really have to try to put some things together. So I want to do that for you a little bit. So look over at chapter 2, verses 9 through 17. And I totally did a typo here. We read 1 through 27, not 1 through 72. So chapter 2 of 1 Chronicles, verses 9 through 17. All right. The sons of Hezron that were born to him, Jeramiel, Ram, and Chelubai. Ram fathered Amminadab, and Amminadab fathered Nashon, prince of the sons of Judah. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. Jesse fathered Eliab, his firstborn, Abinadab the second, Shammai the third, Nethanel the fourth, Radai the fifth, Ozim the sixth, David the seventh. And their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. The sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, Joab, and Asahel three. Abigail bore Amasa. And the father of Amasa was Jether, the Ishmaelite. Okay, so without this little bit of information, you wouldn't understand the craziness that's going on when David is king, and you've got there's this refrain, the sons of Zeruiah. You remember the sons of Zeruiah? Well, it turns out the sons of Zeruiah are David's nephews. It's his sister's boys. And there's also another person in here, and that's Abigail, also David's sister. And she has a son named Amasa. Okay, so this is like a throwaway passage, unless you go back to 2 Samuel 17. So go back to 2 Samuel 17. Verses 24 through 26. Okay, this is the treachery of Absalom. Remember this? Absalom's coming in. He's won the hearts of the people. He wants to be king. He wants to take over. Okay? So 2 Samuel 17, verses 24 through 26. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra, the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, the sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother, and Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. So putting things together. So we're seeing who the sisters and the brothers are. So Absalom comes in, and he removes Joab, who's one of David's nephews, and he installs another of David's nephews. They're cousins. This is like family intrigue going on here. Okay? So look over at chapter 19, verses 11 through 15. So in the midst of all of this, right, Absalom gets killed. Who kills Absalom? Joab does. He runs him through with spears. But Amasa is still out there. And Amasa was the guy who replaced Joab. Right? So they were cousins, and now there's enmity and strife. So take a look, chapter 19, 11 through 15. This is when David returns to Jerusalem. And King David sent this message to Zadok and to Abiathar the priest, say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king? You are my brothers, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? So he's coming back across the Jordan, back into Jerusalem to take over the kingdom again. And say this to Amasa, who, remember, sided with Absalom, was going to try to kill David. And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of my army from now on in the place of Joab. This is weird, you guys. He was just trying to kill David. He just sided with Absalom. In the midst of this whole Absalom thing, David is just messed up. Remember, he's weeping over Absalom's death, the son who tried to kill him. He says, go easy on Absalom. This is the kid who's trying to kill him. And he's mad at Joab, and Joab eventually says, knock this off. Get up, or everybody is going to defect. Okay? So he says, look, it's okay, and I'm going to make you commander in place. And you're like, what? Why would you make the biggest traitor in the world commander in your place? So verse 14, and he swayed the heart of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, return both you and all your servants. So the king came back to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over the Jordan. So all of Judah comes and ushers their king back into the land, gives him this big royal reception. That is not the end of the story. Look over at chapter 20. Okay, so as David's coming back in, there were a lot of traitors, there was a lot of treachery, and David's feeling gracious, I guess we could say. And so he wants to pardon everybody, and he wants to be nice to everybody. The problem is that a lot of times what that does is that actually allows for more treachery to happen. If you're not a hard king, if you're not going to actually do what is right, and some of these people deserve death, then they will be more treacherous at the end. And so enter Joab. And I think I've mentioned this before, Joab is one of my favorite characters in the Bible. He is so conflicted. Sometimes he is so, like he just has such clear moral vision. Other times he's just this weirdo, but he's just a great guy. But remember, Joab and Amasa are cousins. They're the opposite. They were on the opposite teams. And then David promises Amasa to be the general over David's armies instead of Joab. So take a look, chapter 20, verse 4. Again, this is all in the context of family. Okay? Then the king said to Amasa, this is chapter 20, verse 4, call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days and be here yourself. So Amasa went and summoned Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed him. And David said to Abishai, now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to a fortified city and escape from us. And there went out after him Joab's men, the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. So these are like the Navy SEALs going after this guy. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri, When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh, and he went forward, it fell out. Verse 9. And Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand, so Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. So he kills Amasa, and he kills him by treachery. And this is actually what Amasa deserves. He was a traitor of the highest order, and David was so messed up that he had instead put the traitor in the highest general position. And only Joab really realizes this. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri, and one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, and anyone who came by, seeing him, stopped. And when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So it's interesting, this feels like treachery on Joab's part, but Joab actually understands what's going on. He understands what the whole situation is. And the soldiers understand what the situation is. Like, they're like, "Yeah, that was bad. All right, Joab, let's go." Like, they're back following Joab again. There's this sense of justice that's gone on that David couldn't see clearly, but that Joab could. And it's gory. And this is in family. These are cousins that are slaughtering each other, but it's also a nephew who's betraying uncle, and uncle doesn't understand the stakes. So again, there's just a couple of these where you put all of this together and you realize, I think you mentioned a couple times ago, it's like a big crime family. It really is. Except they're in power over the whole country. So as you read through Chronicles, there's these little bits and tidbits of information that if you didn't know before, will start linking stories together and help you understand really what is at stake. I think I mentioned before, I think it was like 10 or 11 years ago, I read Chronicles and I had no idea who Zeruiah was, even though David would say all the time, "You sons of Zeruiah, blah, blah, blah." And it turns out, well, Zeruiah is his sister, and these are his nephews. And it was like, oh my goodness, like the treachery is even greater because this is in the family. So, okay, any questions about genealogies? How we understand genealogies? Okay. All right, let's go on to the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, again, is when all 12 tribes of Israel are basically one nation. And that only really happened for the first three kings, for Saul, for David, and for Solomon. After that, they are divided. The United Kingdom is really what takes up most of the space. And I won't spend a lot of time rehashing it because we've really talked about it. This little map and the other little handouts that I've given you hopefully are enough, but I do want to go over to, let's go to 1 Chronicles 22. One of the things that 1 Chronicles does that we don't see as much in 2 Samuel or in 1 Kings is show how David really helped prepare the temple. Remember, David couldn't build the temple, but David really helped prepare the temple, and he helped Solomon sort of understand what his job would be in preparing the temple. And this is actually a lot of this information we don't have from the other accounts. So this section here in, I think it's 22 through 29, is really rich information for how David really prepared the temple, the priests, the Levites, everybody to get together and to pave the way for the transition from the tabernacle to the temple. But if you look, 1 Chronicles 22, verses 6 through 19, I just want to read this. because we see a little bit more of a discipleship of his son here. Verse 6, and he called for Solomon his son and charged him to build a house for Yahweh, the God of Israel. David said to Solomon, my son, I had it in my heart to build a house to the name of Yahweh my God, but the word of Yahweh came to me saying, you have shed much blood and have waged great wars. You shall not build a house to my name because you have shed so much blood before me on the earth. Behold, a son shall be born to you who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all of his surrounding enemies. For his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. And that's exactly what Solomon means, right? Shalom. It means peace. He shall build a house for my name. He shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever. It's interesting. Like, it seems even what, David has basically prepared Solomon, even from naming him all the way into what he's going to be doing. This is really, I don't want to use the word destiny, but this is really like what Solomon is supposed to do. Verse 11, now my son, Yahweh be with you so that you may succeed in building the house of Yahweh your God as he has spoken concerning you. Only may Yahweh grant you discretion and understanding that when he gives you charge over Israel, you may keep the law of Yahweh your God. Then you will prosper if you are careful to observe the statutes and the rules that Yahweh commanded Moses for Israel. Be strong and courageous. Fear not. Do not be dismayed. Kind of a Moses-Joshua sort of handing off, if you remember. Do not be dismayed. With great pains I have provided for the house of Yahweh 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000,000 talents of silver. That's a massive amount. And bronze and iron beyond weighing, for there is so much of it. Timber and stone too I have provided. To these you must add. You have an abundance of workmen, stonecutters, masons, carpenters, and all kinds of craftsmen without number, skilled in working gold, silver, bronze, and iron. Arise and work, Yahweh be with you. David also commanded all the leaders of Israel to help Solomon his son, saying, is not Yahweh your God with you? And has he not given you peace on every side? For he has delivered the inhabitants of the land into my hand, and the land is subdued before Yahweh and his people. Now set your mind and your heart to seek Yahweh your God. Arise and build the sanctuary of Yahweh God, so that the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and the holy vessels of God may be brought into a house built for the name of Yahweh. So this is really beautiful. This is what David has done. And just like as a little bit of a devotional point, what are some things in here that we see that David does with Solomon that would be good for us as parents to do with our kids? What's that? He encourages. It's just encouraging. Yeah.
He gives him direction.
Gives him direction. Yeah. Here's a plan for you. Here's a path for you. Yeah. Absolutely. What else do we see here? And by the way, I actually think this is really important because so much of what we see throughout the back end of 2 Chronicles and in Kings is that there was zero discipleship from one generation to the next. So I think this section is packed. So encouragement
provides a lot of the materials and the logistics of getting
yeah. Right.
Also winds up the people in doing that whole work.
Yeah.
So he didn't just leave them out there floundering.
Yeah, go get it done. Good luck. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he lines things up. He makes it, really, I think in some ways he makes it easy for his son. He knows his son will have to work, but he makes a bunch of preparations for when he's not there. Yeah. What else? Yeah. Yeah. It's a spiritual passing of the torch as much as it is anything else. Yeah. Absolutely. Anything else we see here?
David.
Yeah. 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 Sure. I think it's interesting also here, like, there's a contentment with David that he didn't do the thing that he wanted to do. And he's just like, all right, like, this is on you. Like, I can't do this, but I can do everything I can to sort of pass that baton. I think especially as we get older, there are things, you know, just general principle, like there are things that, you know, we want to do but can't do or whatever, and we just need to be content passing that on to the next generation, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be fine. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's also interesting in verse 17, David also commanded all the leaders of Israel to help Solomon, his son, saying, like he's making it clear, like, this is my wish, this is the way it's going to go, and I want everybody to help him accomplish this thing for the good of the entire community. So, yeah, I just think this section is actually really, really neat and sweet. It's not really, you know, in the transition of power, you know, in 1 Kings to Solomon, it's just all this controversy and intrigue, and we don't really see this. We don't see this sort of heart to heart that, you know, dad's having with son, you know, kings having with, you know, king to be, because you read like Proverbs and Solomon actually talks about, you know, when I was a young lad and my dad taught me and that sort of thing. Like he writes about it sort of almost third person. But here we see the intimate encouragement from father to son to pick up the task and keep going. Okay. So that's one example where we see more of the successes and more of the nice nature of what is going on rather than a lot of the difficulty and downfall and intrigue in a bad way of the other books. Okay, so we've got the genealogies, we've got the United Kingdom. I'm going to skip over a lot of this because a lot of it is the same or similar to what we've already read. Then we have the divided kingdom. Go over to chapter 28 of 2 Chronicles. Chapter 28 of 2 Chronicles. And we talked last time about the inconsistency from generation to generation, and I mentioned it just a minute ago. But this is, I just think this is amazing, again, to give us a feel for just how pagan Israel had become during the time of the kings. Did I say 28, chapter 28, verses 22 through 29? Yeah, this is Ahaz. In the time of his distress, he became yet more faithless to Yahweh, this same King Ahaz, for he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus that had defeated him and said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me. Like, that's crazy. I'm going to double down on my idolatry because it seems as though these idols are helping my enemies. And so I'm going to sacrifice to them as well. It's just crazy. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God and cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God. And he shut up the doors of the house of Yahweh, and he made himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. He's getting desperate. What, you know, just cutting stuff up from Yahweh's house. Verse 26, now the rest of his acts and all his ways from first to last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and of Israel. And Ahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city in Jerusalem, for they did not bring him into the tombs of the kings of Israel. And Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place. Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh according to all that David, his father, had done. I just want to make one point. Who taught him how to do that?
Probably his mom or somebody
else. Probably his mom. Yeah, his father was utterly wretched. He doubled down and tripled down on his idolatry. And Hezekiah doesn't just pop up out of nowhere in godliness doing things that please the Lord. He was taught that. And I think this is testimony to the power of a mother's influence in their children's life. And we see that with Hezekiah, that it really seems as though his mother, Abijah, gets this shout out. And I don't think that's disconnected to why Hezekiah was so godly. I think there's definitely a connection there. And I wanted to point out something else here. Take a look at verses 3 through 12. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of Yahweh and repaired them. He brought in the priests and the Levites and assembled them in the square on the east. And he said to them, "Hear me, Levites. Now consecrate yourselves and consecrate the house of Yahweh, the God of your fathers, and carry out the filth from the holy place. For our fathers have been unfaithful and have done what was evil in the sight of Yahweh our God. They have forsaken him and have turned away their faces from habitation of Yahweh and turned their backs. They also shut the doors of the vestibule and put out the lamps and have not burned incense or burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel." The altar had been cold. There's just no Yahweh worship at the temple. So all the stuff that David and Solomon had prepared and undertaken, like, they had just closed the doors. They weren't doing it at all. Verse 8, "Therefore the wrath of Yahweh came on Judah and Jerusalem, and he made them as an object of horror, of astonishment, and of hissing, as you see with your own eyes. For behold, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. And now it is in my heart to make a covenant with Yahweh, the God of Israel, in order that his fierce anger may turn away from us. My sons, do not now be negligent, for Yahweh has chosen you to stand in his presence, to minister to him and to be his ministers and make offerings to him." Then the Levites arose, Mahath, the son of Amasai, and Joel, the son of Azariah, of the sons of the Kohathites, and the sons of Merari, Kish, the son of Abdi, and Azariah, the son of Jehalalel, and of the Gershonites, and Joah, and he goes on. And so he charges these guys. We're back. We are worshiping the Lord. And he's not just godly in and of himself, though he is. He's calling people to faithfulness. He's calling people to what they know they should be doing. And he's encouraging them to go. Yeah. Right.
Yahweh.
Get back to work.
Get back to, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So he brings this back. Interesting. Because the doors of the temple had been closed, there was just zero public worship at all of Yahweh. Like, it had just been all completely shut down. If you turn over to chapter 30, it seems like the Passover hadn't been celebrated in many, many years. So the very thing that made them a nation and that they used to worship God making them a nation, the Passover, they didn't celebrate at all. So if you look, chapter 30, verse 1, "Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah and wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of Yahweh at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to Yahweh, the God of Israel. For the king and his princes and all the assembly in Jerusalem had taken counsel to keep the Passover in the second month. For they could not keep it at that time because the priests had not consecrated themselves in sufficient number, nor had the people assembled in Jerusalem." So the Passover is on what month? It's the first month. It's the beginning of their year. But they couldn't do it because they didn't have enough priests who had been consecrated, so they had to wait a month. But they're like, but we're doing it. We're going to do this thing. We're going to celebrate the Passover. Verse 4, and the plan seemed right to the king and to all the assembly. So they decreed to make a proclamation throughout all Israel from Beersheba to Dan that the people should come and keep the Passover to Yahweh, the God of Israel, at Jerusalem, for they had not kept it as often as prescribed. So couriers went throughout all Israel and Judah with letters from the king and his princes, and the king had commanded, saying, O people of Israel, return to Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may turn again to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not be like your fathers and your brothers who were faithless to Yahweh, God of their fathers, so that he made them a desolation, as you see. Do not now be stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourself to Yahweh and come to his sanctuary, which he has consecrated forever, and serve Yahweh your God, that his fierce anger may turn away from you. For if you return to Yahweh, your brothers and your children will find compassion with their captors and return to this land. For Yahweh, your God, is gracious and merciful and will not turn away his face from you if you return to him. So the couriers went from city to city throughout the country of Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun, but they laughed them to scorn and they mocked them. The countryside was still pagan. Verse 11, however, some of the men of Asher and Manasseh and of Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. The hand of God was also on Judah to give them one heart to do what the king and the princes commanded by word of the Lord. I just think that's interesting. They were told to go out by the king to proclaim, hey, we're back, we're worshiping Yahweh, and they were mocked so bad and ridiculed so bad that people were shamed. They didn't even want to do it anymore. Pretty intense. But here's what happens. And many people came together in Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread in the second month, a very great assembly. They set to work and removed the altars that were in Jerusalem and all the altars for burning incense. They took away and threw them into the brook Kidron. And they slaughtered the Passover lamb on the 14th day of the second month. And the priests and the Levites were ashamed, so that they consecrated themselves and brought burnt offerings into the house of Yahweh. They took their accustomed posts according to the law of Moses, the man of God. The priests threw the blood that they received from the hands of the Levites, for there were many in the assembly who had not consecrated themselves. Therefore, the Levites had to slaughter the Passover lamb for everyone who was not clean to consecrate the Lord. So the problem is that they're just everybody's unclean, but they want to celebrate this Passover, and so they're like, we're just going to throw some blood around, and hopefully it will be all right, okay? Verse 18, for a majority of the people, many of them from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves, yet they ate the Passover otherwise than as prescribed. And so this is the problem. Like, well, they want to worship, but they're not ritually pure to do it. So what do you do? Do you like abstain from it or do you do it? What? For Hezekiah had prayed for them, saying, May good Yahweh pardon everyone who sets his heart to seek God. Yahweh, the God of his fathers, even though not according to the sanctuary's rules of cleanness. So what's Hezekiah doing? He's praying that the Lord, he's interceding. Praying, Lord, you know what's up. We want to worship you. Would you cleanse us? Would you do it? Verse 20, and Yahweh heard Hezekiah and he healed the people. And the people of Israel who were present at Jerusalem kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days with great gladness. And the Levites and the priests praised Yahweh day by day, singing with all their might to Yahweh. And Hezekiah spoke encouragingly to all the Levites who showed good skill in the service of Yahweh. So they ate the food of the festival 7 days, sacrificing peace offerings and giving thanks to Yahweh, the God of their fathers. So God blessed it, and God purged them anyway. Then the whole assembly, verse 23, agreed together to keep the feast for another 7 days. So they kept for another 7 days with gladness. For Hezekiah, king of Judah, gave the assembly 1,000 bulls and 7,000 sheep for offering. And the princes gave the assembly 1,000 bulls and 10,000 sheep. Everybody's just pitching in. They're so excited to worship Yahweh again. And Yahweh had blessed them. He had purged them. He had cleansed them. And the temple is now what it was supposed to have been. This is one man who had in his heart who was raised in fear and admonition of the Lord by his mom to purge the land of idolatry. And even though there was pushback, God is blessing what they're doing. It's just so amazing. It's so amazing. And I just can't help myself, but in here, I think, is a picture of the Lord's table, right? We often come to the Lord's table, and we have blood on our hands, and we're not as clean as we ought to be. And you know what? If we come in humility and seek the Lord's pardon, you know what he does? He purges us, and he cleanses us, and reminds us again of the Passover, not in Egypt, but on the cross. Like, he purges us again. So, this is sort of the height of the resurgence. Go to chapter 36, last chapter. So you know Judah eventually suffers downfall. They go into exile. But the last couple of verses of the book, again, they end on hope. Where in Kings, it ended on, and they were all hauled off the land. And it's just like doom and gloom for what had happened. Here, the end is hope. So 2 Chronicles 36, verse 22. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may Yahweh his God be with him. Let him go up. And that's the end. And then the people return. So it ends on a, Chronicles ends on a very hopeful note, that there's good times yet to come. That is our crash course of Chronicles. Questions, you guys? Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot, but it's good. It's good. All right, let's pray. Father, we are so very thankful for your goodness and your faithfulness throughout the generations, from Adam all the way through the return of the exiles through now. You are a faithful God, and you will ever be faithful to your word and to your covenants, and so we thank you for that. Lord, help us to understand our place in history. This history is our history. This redemptive story is our redemptive story of your faithfulness and your goodness, and it all leads up to Jesus. And so we thank you that we're part of this great line. Give us a love for your word, even in the genealogies, even in that, knowing, Lord, that you're faithful, that you fulfill prophecy, that you're good, and you include people into your genealogies that don't deserve to be there, and that gives us hope that we're included in, and we don't deserve to be here. But you show us mercy and grace. So we thank you and we praise you for that grace. In Jesus' name, amen.